9. Rain pattered hard on a raftered roof. The air of the room was dark and clear. Near his couch stood a woman whose face he knew, a proud, gentle, dark face crowned with gold. He wanted to tell her that Mogian was dead, but he could not say the words. He lay there sorely puzzled, for now he recalled that Haldra of Halan was an old woman, white-haired, and the golden-haired woman he had known was long dead, and anyway, he had seen her only once on a planet 8 light-years away, a long time ago, when he had been a man named Rokanan. He tried again to speak. She hushed him, saying in the common tongue, though with some difference in sounds, "Be still, my lord." She stayed beside him, and presently told him in her soft voice, "This is Bregna Castle. You came here with another man in the snow, from the heights of the mountains. You were near death, and still are hurt. There will be time." There was much time, and it slipped by vaguely, peacefully, in the sound of the rain. The next day, or perhaps the next, Jahan came into him. Jahan, very thin, a little lame, his face scarred with frostbite. But a less understandable change in him was his manner, subdued and submissive. After they had talked a while, Rokanan asked uncomfortably, "Are you afraid of me, Jahan?" "I will try not to be, lord," the young man stammered. When he was able to go down to the revel hall of the castle, the same awe or dread was in all faces that turned to him, though they were brave and genial faces. Gold-haired, dark-skinned, a tall people, the old stock of which the Angiar were only a tribe that long ago had wandered north by sea. These were the Liuar, the Earth Lords, living since before the memory of any race here in the foothills of the mountains and the rolling plains to the south. At first he thought that they were unnerved simply by his difference in looks, his dark hair and pale skin. But Jahan was colored like him, and they had no dread of Jahan. They treated him as a lord among lords, which was a joy and a bewilderment to the ex-serf of Halan. But Rokanan they treated as a lord above lords, one set apart. There was one who spoke to him as to a man. The Lady Ganya, daughter-in-law and heiress of the castle's old lord, had been a widow for some months. Her bright-haired little son was with her most of the day. Though shy, the child had no fear of Rokanan, but was rather drawn to him, and liked to ask him questions about the mountains and the northern lands and the sea. Rokanan answered whatever he asked. The mother would listen, serene and gentle as the sunlight, sometimes turning, smiling to Rokanan, her face that he had remembered even as he had seen it for the first time. He asked her at last what it was they thought of him in Bregna Castle, and she answered candidly, "They think you are a god." It was the word he had noted long since in Tolan village, Pedon. "I'm not," he said, dour. She laughed a little. "Why do they think so?" he demanded. "Do the gods of the Liuar come with gray hair and crippled hands?" The laser beam from the helicopter had caught him in the right wrist, and he had lost the use of his right hand almost entirely. "Why not?" said Ganya, with her proud, candid smile. "But the reason is that you came down the mountain." He absorbed this a while. "Tell me, Lady Ganya, do you know of the Guardian of the Well?" At this her face was grave. "We know tales of that people only. It is very long, 9 generations of the Lords of Bregna, since Eolt the Tall went up into the high places and came down changed. We knew you had met with them, with the most ancient." "How do you know?" "In your sleep, in fever, you spoke always of the price, of the cost, of the gift given and its price. Eolt paid too. The cost was your right hand, Lord Olhor?" she asked, with sudden timidity, raising her eyes to his. No, I would give both my hands to have saved what I lost. He got up and went to the window of the tower room, looking out on the spacious country between the mountains and the distant sea. Down from the high foothills where Bregna Castle stood wound a river, widening and shining among lower hills, vanishing into hazy reaches where one could half make out villages, fields, castle towers, and once again the gleam of the river among blue rainstorms and shafts of sunlight. This is the fairest land I ever saw, he said. He was still thinking of Mogian, who would never see it. It's not so fair to me as it once was. Why, Lady Ganya? Because of the strangers. Tell me of them, lady. They came here late last winter, many of them riding in great wind ships, armed with weapons that burn. No one can say what land they come from. There are no tales of them at all. All the land between Viarn River and the sea is theirs now. They killed or drove out all the people of 8 domains. We in the hills here are prisoners. We dare not go down even to the old pasture lands with our herds. We fought the strangers at first. My husband, Ganhing, was killed by their burning weapons. Her gaze went for a second to Rokanan's seared, crippled hand. For a second she paused. In the time of the first thaw he was killed, and still we have no revenge. We bow our heads and avoid their lands, we, the Earth Lords, and there is no man to make these strangers pay for Ganhing's death. Oh, lovely wrath, Rokanan thought, hearing the trumpets of lost Halon in her voice. They will pay, Lady Ganya. They will pay a high price. Though you knew I was no god, did you take me for quite a common man? No, Lord, said she. Not quite. The days went by, the long days of the year-long summer. The white slopes of the peaks above Bregna turned blue. The grain crops in Bregna fields ripened, were cut and re-sown, and were ripening again when one afternoon Rokanan sat down by Jahan in the courtyard, where a pair of young wind steeds were being trained. I'm off again to the south, Jahan. You stay here. No, Olhor, let me come. Jahan stopped, remembering perhaps that foggy beach where in his longing for adventures he had disobeyed Mogian. Rokanan grinned and said, I'll do best alone. It won't take long, one way or the other. But I am your vowed servant, Olhor. Please let me come. Vows break when names are lost. You swore your service to Rokanan on the other side of the mountains. In this land there are no serfs, and there is no man named Rokanan. I ask you, as my friend, Jahan, to say no more to me or to anyone here, but to saddle the steed of Halon for me at daybreak tomorrow. Loyally, next morning before sunrise, Jahan stood waiting for him in the flight court, holding the bridle of the one remaining wind steed from Halon, the gray-striped one. It had made its way a few days after them to Bregna, half-frozen and starving. It was sleek and full of spirit now, snarling and lashing its striped tail. "Do you wear the second skin, Olhor?" Jahan asked in a whisper, fastening the battle straps on Rokanan's legs. "They say the strangers shoot fire at any man who rides near their lands." "I'm wearing it." "But no sword?" "No, no sword. Listen, Jahan, if I don't return, look in the wallet I left in my room. There's some cloth in it with markings in it, and pictures of the land. If any of my people ever come here, give them those, will you? And also the necklace is there." His face darkened, and he looked away a moment. "Give that to the Lady Ganya, if I don't come back to do it myself. Goodbye, Jahan. Wish me good luck." "May your enemy die without sons," Jahan said fiercely, in tears, and let the wind steed go. It shot up into the warm, uncolored sky of summer dawn, turned with a great rowing beat of wings, and catching the north wind, vanished above the hills. Jahan stood watching. From a window high up in Bregna Tower, a soft, dark face also watched, for a long time after it was out of sight and the sun had risen. It was a queer journey Rokanen made, to a place he had never seen and yet knew inside and out with the varying impressions of hundreds of different minds. For though there was no seeing with the mind sense, there was tactile sensation and perception of space and spatial relationships, of time, of motion, and position. From attending to such sensations over and over for hours on end in 100 days of practice, as he sat moveless in his room in Bregna Castle, he had acquired an exact, though unvisualized and unverbalized knowledge of every building and area of the enemy base. And from direct sensation and extrapolation from it, he knew what the base was and why it was here and how to enter it and where to find what he wanted from it. But it was very hard, after the long, intense practice, not to use the mind sense as he approached his enemies, to cut it off, deaden it, using only his eyes and ears and intellect. The incident on the mountainside had warned him that at close range, sensitive individuals might become aware of his presence, though in a vague way, as a hunch or premonition. He had drawn the helicopter pilot to the mountain like a fish on a line, though the pilot probably had never understood what had made him fly that way or why he had felt compelled to fire on the men he found. Now, entering the huge base alone, Rokanen did not want any attention drawn to himself, none at all, for he came as a thief in the night. At sunset, he had left his wind steed tethered in a hillside clearing, and now, after several hours of walking, was approaching a group of buildings across a vast, blank plain of cement, the rocket field. There was only one field, and seldom used, now that all men and materiel were here. War was not waged with light-speed rockets when the nearest civilized planet was 8 light-years away. The base was large, terrifyingly large when seen with one's own eyes. But most of the land and buildings went to housing men. The rebels now had almost their whole army here. While the League wasted its time searching and subduing their home planet, they were staking their gamble on the very high probability of their not being found on this one nameless world among all the worlds of the galaxy. Rokanen knew that some of the giant barracks were empty again. A contingent of soldiers and technicians had been sent out some days ago to take over, as he guessed, a planet they had conquered or had persuaded to join them as allies. Those soldiers would not arrive at that world for almost 10 years. The Faradayans were very sure of themselves. They must be doing well in their war. All they had needed to wreck the safety of the League of All Worlds was a well-hidden base and their 6 mighty weapons. He had chosen a night when, of all 4 moons, only the little captured asteroid Heliki would be in the sky before midnight. It brightened over the hills as he neared a row of hangars, like a black reef on the gray sea of cement, but no one saw him, and he sensed no one near. There were no fences and few guards. Their watch was kept by machines that scanned space for light-years around the Fomalhaut system. What had they to fear, after all, from the Bronze Age aborigines of the little nameless planet? Heliki shone at its brightest as Rokanen left the shadow of the row of hangars. It was halfway through its waning cycle when he reached his goal, the 6 FTL ships. They sat like 6 immense ebony eggs, side by side, under a vague, high canopy, a camouflage net. Around the ships, looking like toys, stood a scattering of trees, the edge of Viarn Forest. Now he had to use his mind-hearing, safe or not. In the shadow of a group of trees, he stood still, and very cautiously, trying to keep his eyes and ears alert at the same time, reached out toward the ovoid ships, into them, around them. In each, he had learned at Bregna, a pilot sat ready day and night to move the ships out, probably to Faraday, in case of emergency. Emergency for the six pilots meant only one thing, that the control room 4 miles away at the east edge of the base had been sabotaged or bombed out. In that case, each was to move his ship out to safety by using its own controls, for these FTLs had controls like any spaceship, independent of any outside vulnerable computers and power sources. But to fly them was to commit suicide. No life survived a faster-than-light trip. So each pilot was not only a highly trained polynomial mathematician, but a sacrificial fanatic. They were a picked lot. All the same, they got bored sitting and waiting for their unlikely blaze of glory. In one of the ships tonight, Rokanen sensed the presence of two men. Both were deeply absorbed. Between them was a plain surface cut in squares. Rokanen had picked up the same impression on many earlier nights, and his rational mind registered chessboard, while his mind hearing moved on to the next ship. It was empty. He went quickly across the dim gray field among scattered trees to the fifth ship in line, climbed its ramp, and entered the open port. Inside, it had no resemblance to a ship of any kind. It was all rocket hangars and launching pads, computer banks, reactors, a kind of cramped and deathly labyrinth with corridors wide enough to roll City Buster missiles through. Since it did not proceed through space-time, it had no forward or back end, no logic, and he could not read the language of the signs. There was no live mind to reach to as a guide. He spent 20 minutes searching for the control room, methodically, repressing panic, forcing himself not to use the mind-hearing, lest the absent pilot become uneasy. Only for a moment, when he had located the control room and found the Ansible and sat down before it, did he permit his mind-sense to drift over to the ship that sat east of this one. There he picked up a vivid sensation of a dubious hand hovering over a white bishop. He withdrew at once. Noting the coordinates at which the Ansible sender was set, he changed them to the coordinates of the League Hilf Survey Base for Galactic Area 8 at Kerguelen on the planet New South Georgia, the only coordinates he knew without reference to a handbook. He set the machine to transmit and began to type. As his fingers, left hand only, awkwardly, struck each key, the letter appeared simultaneously on a small black screen in a room in a city on a planet 8 light-years distant. Urgent to League Presidium, the FTL warship base of the Faradayan Revolt is on Fomalhaut 2, southwest continent, 28 degrees 28 minutes north by 121 degrees 40 minutes west, about 3 kilometers northeast of a major river. Base blacked out, but should be visible as 4 building squares, 28 barrack groups, and hangar on rocket field running east-west. The 6 FTLs are not on the base, but in open just southwest of rocket field at edge of a forest, and are camouflaged with net and light absorbers. Do not attack indiscriminately, as aborigines are not inculpated. This is Gavril Rokanen of Fomalhaut Ethnographic Survey. I am the only survivor of the expedition. Am sending from Ansible aboard grounded enemy FTL. About 5 hours till daylight here. He had intended to add, give me a couple of hours to get clear, but did not. If he were caught as he left, the Faradayans would be warned and might move out the FTLs. He switched the transmitter off and reset the coordinates to their previous destination. As he made his way out along the catwalks in the huge corridors, he checked the next ship again. The chess players were up and moving about. He broke into a run, alone in the half-lit, meaningless rooms and corridors. He thought he had taken a wrong turning, but went straight to the port, down the ramp, and off at a dead run past the interminable length of the ship, past the interminable length of the next ship, and into the darkness of the forest. Once under the trees, he could run no more, for his breath burned in his chest, and the black branches let no moonlight through. He went on as fast as he could, working back around the edge of the base to the end of the rocket field, and then back the way he had come, across country, helped out by Heliki's next cycle of brightness, and after another hour by Feni rising. He seemed to make no progress through the dark land, and time was running out. If they bombed the base while he was this close, shockwave or firestorm would get him, and he struggled through the darkness with the irrepressible fear of the light that might break behind him and destroy him. But why did they not come? Why were they so slow? It was not yet daybreak when he got to the double-peaked hill where he had left his windsteed. The beast, annoyed at being tied up all night in good hunting country, growled at him. He leaned against its warm shoulder, scratching its ear a little, thinking of Keo. When he had got his breath, he mounted and urged the steed to walk. For a long time it crouched, sphinx-like, and would not even rise. At last it got up, protesting in a sing-song snarl, and paced northward with maddening slowness. Hills and fields, abandoned villages, and hoary trees were now faint all about them. But not till the white of sunrise spilled over the eastern hills would the wind steed fly. Finally it soared up, found a convenient wind, and floated along through the pale, bright dawn. Now and then Rokanan looked back. Nothing was behind him but the peaceful land, mist lying in the river bottom westward. He listened with the mind sense and felt the thoughts and motions and wakening dreams of his enemies going on as usual. He had done what he could do. He had been a fool to think he could do anything. What was one man alone against a people bent on war? Worn out, chewing wearily on his defeat, he rode on toward Bregna, the only place he had to go. He wondered no longer why the League delayed their attack so long. They were not coming. They had thought his message a trick, a trap. Or, for all he knew, he had misremembered the coordinates. One figure wrong had sent his message out into the void where there was neither time nor space. And for that, Raho had died. Iot had died. Mogian had died. For a message that got nowhere. And he was exiled here for the rest of his life, useless, a stranger on an alien world. It did not matter after all. He was only one man. One man's fate is not important. If it is not, what is? He could not endure those remembered words. He looked back once more to look away from the memory of Mogian's face, and with a cry threw up his crippled arm to shut out the intolerable light, the tall white tree of fire that sprang up soundless on the plains behind him. In the noise and the blast of wind that followed, the wind steed screamed and bolted, then dropped down to earth in terror. Rokanan got free of the saddle and cowered down on the ground with his head in his arms, but he could not shut it out. Not the light, but the darkness. The darkness that blinded his mind, the knowledge in his own flesh of the death of 1,000 men all in one moment. Death, 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 over and over, and yet all at once in one moment in his one body and brain. And after it, silence. He lifted his head and listened and heard silence.